From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine, filling in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
She looked at me, she said, "This is destiny." So that made me feel really good. Also scared the crap out of me that we better deliver.
Tom Quinn of Radius Films explains why you may have missed seeing the critically acclaimed thriller Snowpiercer in theaters this summer, and how under his plan to distribute the movie on multiple platforms, that's not necessarily a problem. And later, we'll talk to first-time director Charlie McDowell and longtime indie actor and producer Mark Duplass about The One I Love, another Radius film with a unique rollout. But first, on the news banter, the Emmys are upon us. And will Coldplay pay to play? The NFL wants halftime performers to pony up. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I'm here joined by my banter partner, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hey, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Emmy fever. Are you catching it?
I'm catching the subway is what I'm doing to try to get downtown and miss all the traffic from the Emmys being on a Monday this year.
Yeah, this limo debacle that we've been talking about is pretty fascinating. People are going to have to share rides, apparently. They're not shutting down any streets downtown, and everyone is fearing the Emmy-geddon.
Yeah, file that under Hollywood problems where, you know, there's going to be a limo crunch. But, you know, it is a real problem. There's a lot of parking issues downtown. And, you know, NBC's decision to move the Emmys to a Monday to avoid football on Sunday night is really causing reverberations. There are a lot of unhappy people.
Right, right. And so they're avoiding football on Monday night. But more importantly, they're avoiding the VMAs, which Emmys versus Video Music Awards, VMAs wins. And so they're in an embarrassing situation of having to cower behind the VMAs and go on a Monday night, which no one in town seems to be happy with, and it's going to be really interesting to see if anyone at home actually watches.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the Emmys are going to be live at 5 o'clock on the West Coast when most people are in their cars, I think will probably have a pretty negative impact on the ratings.
So, Matt, the other grumbling that's going on is, of course, the issue of categories. And this year, more than ever, we've seen shows in certain categories that don't quite belong there, but yet they're there because the people who submit these shows or actors are pretty much allowed to put them where they feel may give them a little more of a leg up. So you have Orange is the New Black in the comedy category, although there's some debate over whether that's a comedy. And then you have this real issue of True Detective in the drama series category versus Fargo in the limited series, the miniseries category.
Yeah, I mean, by all objective observation, True Detective is a miniseries. It is 8 episodes. The cast will completely change, the location and everything will change for the second season. That's a miniseries. So I think HBO's strategic plan to put that in the series category, we'll see if it pays off, but it sort of makes a mockery of the whole system.
And meanwhile, you have broadcast shows that are being shoved out because of these shorter run cable shows. And, you know, The Good Wife, actually, part of their campaign was pointing out, hey, we do 22 episodes a season, whereas some of these guys do as few as 8. So it is apples and oranges.
Yeah.
But of course, The Good Wife didn't get a nomination.
And then you have what AMC does, which is that they split their seasons in order to give their shows an extra year of eligibility. And you have Breaking Bad, which went off the air last summer, still competing in the drama series category, even though, you know, that should have ended a year ago.
And they split Mad Men into 2 semi-seasons. And so both of those half seasons will actually be eligible for different Emmy years, which is another fascinating thing. But speaking of AMC and speaking of Mad Men, as that show goes off the air and Breaking Bad has already gone off the air, new shows have popped up, but they haven't been getting the kind of audiences that those two sort of network-defining shows perform for that network. And so you have an AMC in transition.
Yeah, I think AMC is sort of a victim of its own success. Kim Masters actually had a very interesting piece in The Hollywood Reporter this week about some of the challenges AMC is facing without Breaking Bad and Mad Men. It leaped out of the gate into this whole golden age of television. And now you look at their upcoming schedule, they don't have anything for the rest of 2014 in terms of new shows. They've got this Better Call Saul spinoff of Breaking Bad scheduled for next year, but that was already delayed once. And then they've sort of got a bare cupboard. They don't really have much, and it'll be interesting to see how AMC adjusts to life without Breaking Bad and Mad Men.
Well, one of the answers is, as you mentioned, they're going back to the well. So they have a Walking Dead spinoff coming up, and then they have Better Call Saul. So a lot of this now is sort of going back to what worked and hoping that maybe they can prolong that success for a while. But on the flip side, the new shows that have come along, like Halt and Catch Fire and Turn, have only done so-so. But because the cupboard is bare, they're still picking them up for future seasons and hoping for the best.
Yeah, I think the fact that AMC renewed Halt and Catch Fire, which has very low ratings, even with DVR usage, that to me indicates that there's trouble there and they just need something to put on the air.
Now, speaking of networks looking to expand their horizons, of course, CBS added another night of football this year. Thursday night football comes this fall. The NFL is taking over prime time. And obviously, the biggest event of the year in television is the Super Bowl. And Matt, this is fascinating. The fact that the NFL is actually now asking potential halftime performers to maybe cut a little something-something for them, as if they're not already making plenty on this highly rated event.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal reported last week that the NFL was asking Coldplay to potentially pay for the right to play on the Super Bowl halftime show, which is basically an acknowledgement that, you know, they've got this major platform that delivers 100 million viewers each year. There's nothing like it in television, and there really is a promotional value to that. So to the NFL, it makes sense to say, you know what, pay up if you want access to that.
Yeah, but of course you don't pay to play at the Grammys or at the VMAs. Now, granted, the Super Bowl is more than triple the audience for the Grammys and more than 11 times the size of the VMAs. But nonetheless, this is coming off a little money grubbing for the NFL.
Absolutely. I think that what's interesting now that it's been leaked and that the NFL has sort of been shamed, it'll be interesting to see who accepts that job now, because it's kind of been tainted. People are going to ask, you know, hey, Beyonce, if you're doing the Super Bowl, did you pay for that? And I don't think Beyonce's ego wants to handle those kind of questions.
Yeah. And honestly, the kind of artist that might end up actually agreeing to this deal may not be the artist that you want to see in halftime anyway.
No, but they made an interesting choice last year. They went with Bruno Mars for the Super Bowl halftime show, which is not the typical legacy megastar that you see, and it worked out well for them. The Super Bowl had record ratings, and Bruno Mars, I'm sure, got a huge bump off that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So if there's anything to be said, it's probably the best gig in all of Hollywood.
Definitely. It's definitely the most watched. And that's, you know, when you're looking to promote an act, that's what you want. You want people to check it out. It's all ages. It's all races. Every single person has exposure to the Super Bowl, 100 million of them. So there's nothing like it.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, the executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. The sci-fi action thriller Snowpiercer is exactly the type of movie you'd think would be a hit on summer screens. Directed by Bong Joon-ho, Snowpiercer tells the story of a grim future where the planet has been plunged into a new ice age. The few humans left alive now make their home on a high-speed train circling around the globe. There's a strict class system on the train, and those in the front enjoy a life of wealth and luxury, and those in the back, on the other hand, live in squalor. And among them, a movement for change is now afoot. Tilda Swinton plays Minister Mason. She talks to the tail-end revolutionaries and their leader, Curtis Everett, played by Chris Evans, on behalf of Wilford, the creator of the train.
You repay his kindness with violent hooliganism, you scum! Precisely 74% of you shall die. My friend, you suffer from the misplaced optimism of the doomed.
Despite the notable cast, director, and critical acclaim, Snowpiercer had a very small initial opening in theaters and then quickly went to video on demand. The rollout had some fans scratching their heads. Recently, the business host Kim Masters sat down with Tom Quinn, who's the co-president of Radius, which is the boutique label of the Weinstein Company that distributed Snowpiercer. He told her why he opted for an unconventional release plan.
So tell me about the genesis of the movie itself, Snowpiercer, Tom.
The industry term for it would be a pre-buy. Based on script and some footage, while the film was early in production, Harvey and the Weinstein Company bought the film for all English language rights.
And at the time of the buying of the film, it was meant to be a regular theatrical distribution, correct?
Yeah, it was bought as a traditional theatrical release.
So I know that there was a point where you guys looked at the movie and thought it doesn't necessarily play like in a wide release. But just walk me through that part.
I was not involved in the buying of the movie, but having worked with director Bong Joon-ho on three other movies in my previous job at Magnolia Pictures, my only recommendation to the team at the Weinstein Company was, you know, Bong's never made a bad movie. I think this sounds like a great idea. And lo and behold, many, many months later, we all as a team came together, which includes CJ, the financier, the Korean production company as well as distributor there, and international sales rep, director Bong, the producers, and the Weinstein Company, Harvey, and David Glasser.
Who is the COO. He's the chief operating officer.
Exactly. We all decided together that this was a film that sort of fell in that middle ground of, well, could it be a wide release? Sure. Could it be an independent release, something along the lines of 600 prints and under? Absolutely. But falling in between there is sort of a no man's land. You know, it's littered with largely a lot of box office failures. And so the idea to greenlight P&A spend at minimum $15 million, going out 2,500 prints.
When you say P&A, you're talking about the cost of prints and advertising.
Exactly.
Mostly advertising, right?
Mostly. Absolutely. Because there are no prints anymore, as you know.
And you said 15? Because that's a low number.
That's a very low number. So even considering a conservative number, modeling that out, and then taking other factors into consideration, you know, the two examples that I've been looking at and would comp directly with Snowpiercer, one is a sci-fi film, Children of Men, and the other is Drive. I think they both fit the same review profile. They each grossed approximately $35 million in the U.S. You know, it's not an exact science, but looking at all of these numbers, where do you place Snowpiercer in that paradigm, that release strategy? And I don't think that it necessarily made sense that we would get to $50 million, that we would even exceed $35 million. And if you're banking on somewhere spending $15 to $25 million and you get to $35 million, and we all agree that Drive and Children of Men are successes, and in some respects maybe only perceived successes.
And to touch on what you were saying earlier, just to clarify, I mean, you could hear a number like $35 million on a movie and think, well, it cost 15, so why isn't that good? But it's because of all the costs associated with releasing the movie, or in this case, acquiring the rights to the movie. So a number that sounds like, you know, kind of double doesn't cut it.
It doesn't. And, you know, it's a very unfortunately simple way to talk about the economics of the film industry. You know, that $35 million is not what the distributor recoups, as you and your audience well know. And it also doesn't illustrate what they would do on DVD and VOD in their traditional
right.
home entertainment window. But it is a good starting point. And I think these films, they're all, I think, very relevant in trying to dial down to the minutiae of whether or not what we did was the right thing for Snowpiercer. And I believe so far, it's proven that it is.
So let me talk about the distribution plan for Snowpiercer. You put it in theaters on June 27th, and that was eight theaters, just eight, for the first weekend. And then you did roll it out. But 2 weeks after you put it in the theaters, you had it available on demand.
On July 11th. Yeah.
Which is very, very unusual. Well, normally, a theater owner doesn't want to book a film in a theater if it's not going to be there for, like, have a 90-day window.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a pretty hard and fast rule with exhibitors. And, you know, we went into this release strategy being as transparent as we are about what the release strategy is with each and every theater owner. And so they were all on board for this particular
I just want to pursue that a tiny bit more. I mean, you said to them that we're going to do this way. And they say, what?
So they say, okay, are you sure? But it's the same players that came on board and have been working with us for several years in the multi-platform model. I can't say that there are many new exhibitors who've come on board to support Snowpiercer. There are a few, and there are actually some exhibitors who do support multi-platform who wound up actually not coming on board, and those exhibitors shall remain nameless. But, you know, I'm pleased with where we're at theatrically. Would I have liked other exhibitors to come on board? Yes, because I think the film has actually worked quite well theatrically and is still producing numbers.
Now, when you decided to do this, did you go to the director and say, we have a surprise for you? We're not going to do this the way you think we're going to do it.
The good news is we've come a long way since we first started doing this many years ago at Magnolia. So our brothers and sisters in Hollywood and the producers that we've worked with have seen the merits of what we're doing. Director Bong, I think what helped us in this particular scenario is that we've worked together before, and my commitment to what he wants to accomplish in his career is everything to me, and I think it would be a horrible situation for us to present a model that we didn't believe in, that we didn't think could work.
So he was okay. He said, I trust you?
He put his faith in me, and you know, seeing his wife at the premiere, she looked at me and she said, this is destiny. So that made me feel really good. Also scared the crap out of me that we better deliver.
And I should think so.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, since you, I mean, you've sort of been the victim of your own success in a way, because since the movie came out, the critics loved it. I almost think you probably hate the high score you got on Rotten Tomatoes, because it's been brought up so many times, a 94% or something on Rotten Tomatoes.
I would actually say it's 95%
on Rotten Tomatoes. And everybody's like, wow, it's 95% on Rotten Tomatoes. What are they thinking? Why didn't they keep it in theaters? They could have made so much more money. And I know you're arguing that otherwise, but I'm not quite sure how you actually could know what it would have done had you left it in theaters.
No, I don't think anybody does know. You know, all we can do is forecast as best we can with the information that we have. And, you know, these numbers speak to the fact that, yes, it's a very critically driven film. I think it works exceptionally well in the major art markets in a very commercial way, which it's proven and is proving certainly on VOD, and then has a much larger mainstream audience based on the cast and possibly based on the genre. But, you know, even on second viewing, I mean, here's the benefit of being on VOD. A lot of people come back to this movie a second, third, fourth, fifth time. You know, I think the immediacy of that and how it shows up in social media, you know, speak directly to what the themes of this movie are.
So you released numbers on your VOD. Are they called grosses? I don't even know, revenues.
Well, they are called grosses. And, you know, here's another, I guess, fallacy is that, you know, box office is a gross number. And in the VOD world, they're not ranked on gross. They're actually ranked on units. And so when you see us as Snowpiercer hitting number one on iTunes or, you know, number six overall for all the cable platforms, you know, that number really means something because we're actually at a multi-platform price point. You know, the usual traditional home entertainment window price is $4. We're offering our film, since it's in the first window, at $7, which is not far off from an average ticket price. And so to not only be number one, ranking in the top 10 against these other movies, but then also being able to charge almost double what those films are charging based on the early availability. I mean, these kinds of economics all start to add up in a way that make this a really profoundly effective model.
You know, your friends at IndieWire, who spend a lot of time on independent film, they did this breakdown of your what they thought your projection would be, and they came away and said, you left money on the table. That was the big Snowpiercer question. Did they leave money on the table? Did they cannibalize the potential box office revenue from the theater by going with this very quick 2 weeks later video on demand thing? But you disagree with the conclusion that you left money on the table.
Oh, I absolutely disagree with the conclusion. I mean, you know, unfortunately, Tom doesn't know what I've spent to do what we've done. You know, I'm not going to disclose that. But there's a good possibility that we actually break even on our P&A spend based on what we recoup theatrically. And so that changes the dynamic big time.
You cover your marketing costs through the theater and then what? The VOD stuff is all gravy.
Absolutely.
Am I getting this? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
And so the other part is we're not factoring in TV, streaming rights, or DVD. And so I thought his attempt was great. And I applaud it. And it's gotten a lot of attention.
You didn't send him a cease and desist letter?
No, God, no. But some of it's wrong, unfortunately. So, but I, listen, nobody else tried what he did. And I thought he made some really good points. I mean, for me, the point is that the access to eyeballs is a far greater proposition on VOD than what we can accomplish theatrically for this particular film.
Tom Quinn is the co-president of Radius, the boutique label of the Weinstein Company. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Coming up after a short break, we look at another Radius film, The One I Love. This one comes with a twist, both in its plot and its distribution plan. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is The Business, and I'm Michael Schneider of TV Guide Magazine, filling in for Kim Masters. In addition to Snowpiercer, there's another film that Radius, the boutique label of the Weinstein Company, is rolling out this summer. This one is called The One I Love, and it's the directorial debut of Charlie McDowell, who's the son of actors Malcolm McDowell and Mary Steenburgen. In the film, Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss play Ethan and Sophie, a couple that have seen happier times. Their therapist sends them off on a weekend getaway to relax, but once they arrive at the beautiful hillside retreat, things start to get a little weird.
I think the important thing is that, you know, we fought, we made up, we had a nice cuddle, it's a beautiful day.
Sophie, what are you talking about? We had a fight and you stormed out. We didn't make up.
Baby, are you okay?
I'm fine. Are you okay? I'm
okay, Mr. Hangover. I think it's time for some food. Huh? Let's get something in your stomach.
You're kind of freaking me out a little bit, Sophie. I gotta stop. Is that bacon?
Yeah.
You hate it when I eat bacon.
And cue the creepy music. So we won't spoil the movie's big twists and turns, but if you want to find out what's going on between Sophie and Ethan, the film's now out in theaters, but it's also available on VOD and has been since the start of August. Charlie McDowell and Mark Duplass spoke to us from San Francisco, where they're promoting the theatrical release of the film. So talk about the thinking behind releasing it via VOD first.
Yeah, there's a big debate going on in the film industry about should we preserve the theatrical experience, and is day-and-date releasing, you know, i.e. going in theaters and on VOD at the same time, ruining some of that? Or is it time for us to say, hey, this is a great new way for people to see movies, let's embrace it? And Charlie and I are both very conflicted on the matter, for sure. You know, we've watched this movie play in the theater, and it's this great communal experience, and there's a lot of mystery to the film, and we love that experience and we want people to have it. That being said, you know, there are certain people that can't make it to the movie theater because they either have little kids or the film won't play in their small town. So then you start to talk about, well, what's a way they can see it? And certainly VOD is a good option for that. And in the case of this film specifically, our film releasing company, Radius, and Charlie and our producers and myself all sort of discussed this idea of, well, look, what if we do an early VOD release for this film. We still promote this thing as a theatrical release, but we quietly put it out on VOD as a means to sort of build word of mouth about the movie, which we realize has been one of our biggest sellers. People come out of the movie and they're just so surprised by it and excited about it. They talk about it. So we've used VOD, you know, not only as a decent revenue stream, but more importantly, sort of a groundswell of word of mouth marketing.
Yeah, talk about how you guys had a hand in sort of determining how this movie was going to roll out. You mentioned that you all sat down and discussed this. Where did the idea come from? Was it Radius that sort of brought this up? And what were some of your reservations?
Well, when we took the film to Sundance, and we felt like that was going to be the kind of only screening where we would get the kind of true audience that would know nothing going into it. And what we realized the next day after we premiered was that everyone was kind of keeping it a secret. The reviews came out and they said, we really like this little movie. You got to go see it. We're not going to tell you what it's about. And we were like, okay, wait a minute. There's something to that. And then we looked on social media and people were saying the same thing. So it was actually people that were preserving it that kind of gave us the idea. And so then when Radius came on board, we kind of discussed this with them, and they had really liked seeing the movie, not knowing anything as well. So then we kind of embraced the challenge as to how do we market this movie and get it out there and intrigue people and have them want to go see it in the theater without telling them what the plot is.
But does that make you nervous that the film is already out there before it hits theaters and you know, first at Sundance, now on VOD, that the plot could end up all over the internet?
You know, we thought there was a danger if we released the movie a little bit earlier before theaters that it could get out. But we've been relying on viewers and reviewers alike to be respectful about it. And they kind of have been.
For us, it's not like we're only using it as this is like our own marketing campaign. We really feel like the best way to view this movie, because it does play in different genres and it kind of jumps around tonally, you know, it plays with romantic comedy, it plays with sci-fi, it plays with mystery and has all these elements to it. So there isn't kind of one thing that you can say this is what it is. And so for us, we think the best way to experience it is to just go in cold. And that's kind of been just our own personal belief in the movie. And then it happens to work really well with the marketing campaign because it is something to talk about. And it's like, how do you separate yourself from all the other indie films that premiered at Sundance that are coming out this month? And this is a way for us to separate ourselves.
I was going to ask you, looking at iTunes, we noticed that the film cost about $14.99 before the theatrical release. That seems like a high price point, but this is kind of a brave new world. So is that, do you think, a barrier to entry, or does the price drop at some point once the movie hits theaters, or how does that work?
Yeah, there's a pretty standard business model for what's called Ultra VOD, which is it's $15 to buy but $10 to rent when it's in the space before it comes out in theaters. And that's standard for most movies. And then what happens is the day your movie comes out in theaters, it drops down to $6.99 to rent. So I think without knowing exactly what audiences are thinking, our feeling is that there's a group of rabid fans out there that are going to pay the higher price point up front, and iTunes does a very good job of promoting internally with that stuff. And then there's going to be a big swell of press around the movie starting this week, where we really are promoting it and really telling audiences to come see it when it opens in theaters. And for those people who are not in a city where it is opening theatrically, they're going to have the opportunity to see it for less than $7 with all the press wave behind it. And hopefully, if there was a barrier due to that higher price point, the sort of symmetry of all the press hitting them, which has been pretty positive, and the lower price point would sort of break through that.
Do you guys get a lot of statistics on the VOD viewing? Are you able to crunch numbers and really sort of get a good gauge on who's watching it and you know, anything that you can kind of take away from who's you know, buying it so far?
You know, VOD numbers have traditionally been very non-transparent. It's been a big gripe in the independent film business is that, look, we have RentTrak reporting box office. VOD is becoming a viable model for independent film income. Why are we not having transparency? And companies like IFC and guys like John Sloss from Cinetic Media and companies like Radius, who is releasing The One I Love, are trying to break down this model right now. And they're kind of stepping their foot right over that line that's been drawn and saying, you know what, we're going to start reporting these numbers. So Charlie and I are very business-oriented filmmakers. We're interested in the indie film model, not as just a stepping stone to Hollywood, but as a model in itself that can be sustainable creatively, but also financially. So, you know, with a little bit of pushing and a little bit of prodding, slowly but surely, the indie film industry is starting to be a little more transparent with those VOD numbers. And, you know, everybody's starting to see, wow, this is a place where, you know, we can get a pretty steady revenue stream, and there are a lot of people who are not able to go see movies in theaters, and they're seeing them here. So this is kind of here to stay. So we should figure out a way that we can make this a part of, you know, the standard business reporting procedure.
Does it matter to either of you whether people watch it at home or in a theater, or would you prefer that they watch it in the theater, or is this a model that you just have come to terms with?
I personally think that this film is a theater movie just because there is an element of surprise and there are so many kind of twists and turns in the plot that the audience starts to pick it up at different times. And so you really do feed off the energy of other people in the room. So I think, you know, we prefer people to see it in the theater if it's playing in their city. But then at the same time, it's a really good movie to watch with your significant other because it goes to really sort of dark and deep places, and it is a kind of thought-provoking movie. So it's also good to watch in your home if it's not playing in your hometown.
Well, Charlie McDowell is the director, and Mark Duplass is the star and executive producer of the film The One I Love, which is out now in theaters and available on VOD. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Melissa Morton. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Michael Schneider. We'll see you next week on The Business.